Lori Childers and played by Lori Childers and Kent White.
KBOO Community Radio currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. A $100 new or increased donation will become $200 to support the important work of KBOO.
If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors up to $10,000. Consider becoming a monthly sustaining member. This can be set up easily and securely online. Over 70% of KBOO's income is from you, our listeners, who take action to become KBOO members.
Go to kboo.fm/support to have your donation matched today, or mail your donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
I used to think democracy a quixotic quest, now merely Sisyphean. In this edition of Democracy Here, we explore the demolition epidemic going on in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Joe Meyer. Portland is one of the most developer-friendly cities in the nation, and our neighborhoods are losing a century-old home to the wrecking ball every day. Our historic downtown buildings also have little protection from the developer's bottom line. What is the proper balance between property owner rights and the rights of their neighbors? How can today's Portland learn from yesterday's architecture? Are other municipalities doing better? For answers to these questions and more, I spoke with Peggy Moretti and Brandon Spencer Hartle from Restore Oregon. Peggy, will you say a few words about Restore Oregon to start, please?
Well, Restore Oregon is actually Oregon's only statewide nonprofit that is all focused on historic preservation, saving historic places that define our story here in Oregon and embody our heritage. Something we do every year is we announce a list of Oregon's most endangered places, and then we very actively work to help those places become repurposed and viable again and reactivated. So we just announced a list about 3 weeks ago. There's 15 endangered places you can find on our website, restoreoregon.org, and you can track how things unfold for those places and how we work to save them. And they're really widely varied in the types of places, from pioneer type places on up to at residential, commercial. So we have, and all over the state, some of them are very much out in the middle of the wilds of Oregon, and others are here in the urban setting. But they all tell an important story. They're all irreplaceable. They all embody our heritage, and we're excited to dig in and start working with them.
Nice. And Brandon, you also work with historic preservation.
I do. I've been at Restore Oregon for about 5 years and have an academic background in historic preservation. And at Restore Oregon, we've been working on a host of issues around the state, many of which this last year have been in the areas of public policy. So working on legal and legislative issues to bring historic preservation to the forefront of livability and Main Street redevelopment and adaptive reuse.
You work at the state level mostly or local?
It's a little bit of both. The last year has brought us quite a bit of involvement here in the city of Portland, but we've been involved in cities across the state. And there are about 77 communities that participate in the Oregon Main Street program, and we're heavily involved with that program as well.
Nice. Well, the way I got into this, I was biking downtown with my wife, and the Second and Taylor, this is a beautiful building I pointed out, and my wife, who happens to be an architect, said it was slated for the wrecking ball, and I just had this image of this old-fashioned wrecking ball going through that gorgeous building, and I didn't know how that could be. I guess I felt an ownership interest for some reason in that. In your work, do you also feel a kind of an ownership interest in these old buildings? Or?
Yes, because the identity of a place is often embodied in the buildings and the stories they tell and the purposes they served and the time period in which they were built, but also the decades in following that in which so much life and commerce and trials and tribulations have gone on in them. So they really do embody a community's story. And right now in the Portland metro area, there's what we're calling a demolition epidemic going on in a lot of the older neighborhoods, the residential neighborhoods. But it's also starting to spread a little bit into our downtown historic buildings as well. And we are very actively working to stay on top of that and find the right balance between growth and development, but also the preservation of the historic character and the integrity of our neighborhoods.
Great. Brandon, can you say something about that building? Mm-hmm. I guess it's the Ancient Order of United Workmen's Temple.
I can. It's an early 1890s building, era of which we have very few buildings left in downtown Portland, and a scale of building at 5-6 stories that we have very few pre-1900 buildings of that scale. The building's been underutilized for quite some time, but when we look at it as a historic building, it's eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. It tells a unique story, both of architecture, it was designed by a prominent architect at the time, Justice Crumbine, and also social history. It was built as the Ancient Order of Workmen's Temple. And we don't have that many fraternal lodges left, especially in downtown Portland. Oftentimes, those buildings, when we look around the country and around the state, are adapted towards creative new uses. And I think when we see a building like that, while it certainly has its challenges, we have no indication that it's too far gone to be rehabilitated and restored.
Right. Can you say something more about the social aspect of it? I understand it was sort of life insurance for everybody.
For the Workman's Temple?
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the interesting things, and actually this has been a growing interest here in the Portland area, is looking at some of these early civic institutions, not just the Ancient Order of the United Workmen, but fraternal lodges generally. There's been a National Register nomination prepared for Portland's history of early social organizations, community benefit organizations, and this building has the opportunity to tell that story. What's interesting is in Oregon, unlike any other state in the country, cities can't decide buildings are landmarks without the owner's agreement. And one of the missed opportunities with this building is the opportunity to put together its story in a landmark nomination or a National Register nomination, where we can really understand what was the role of that institution here in Portland 100 years ago, and how can the community learn from that today.
Was it an opulent building for its time?
I don't know that I would say opulent. It was designed by an architect who was known to do quality downtown buildings, and there's very few of those left. And one of the things with that part of town especially is if you stepped into that corner of downtown Portland in 1900, you would see many buildings that looked similar, 4 or 5 stories, brick, Italianate. You would see early terracotta and cast iron architecture. And now there's very little of that left. And when we look at the area around City Hall and Portland State, this represents one of the last reminders of what that part of town once was. And it's fortunate because this was designed by an architect who knew what he was doing.
Right. And Peggy, I guess this was sort of on its way to becoming a historic resource when it was put on some inventory in 1984.
Yes, there was an inventory taken, which was really, I have a saying, you cannot manage what you cannot measure. You know, if you don't know what you have, you can't be a good steward of it. So back in the 80s, a historic resource inventory was conducted, and this building was on it. So that's like the very most basic, simplest, lowest level of historic designation, which is, and it's different than the National Register. That's the more specific kind of national level of designation that brings with it other incentives that can help tax credits and so forth that can help offset costs for restoration. So, but here, as Brandon was mentioning, because in Oregon and only in Oregon is owner consent required for historic designation at any level, you can just ask for that designation to be removed, and that clears the way for demolition permits and so forth. Now, a demolition permit has not been pulled on this building yet, but the most current plans that have been reviewed or looked at definitely show the building's gone. So we did speak with the development team, or a couple members from the development team, and they gave us a little hope that there might be an alternative strategy if it could be brought forward. And I think this is where it's so important that there be some kind of public dialogue. When you lose a property like that, a building like that, and all the history that embodies all of its the benefits, the public benefits of having those historic places retained. It doesn't make any sense to us at all that we should have a policy here in Portland that a simple filing of a piece of paper can pull that, can just remove that building and clear the way for demolition. It seems like there should be some public engagement in that process, and certainly an opportunity, a delay period for there to be alternative ideas pursued.
Can you say something more about how it was delisted? It only needs to be requested. There's no review whatsoever.
Yeah, it's just basically a submission about, I don't know what the form exactly looks like, Brandon, do you? But it's basically file a piece of paper.
So here in the city of Portland, we have properties that are on the National Register, and we pay quite a bit of attention to those to protect those and make sure there's public hearings and that sort of thing. But those group of 5,000 properties that are on this inventory, which again is sort of the base of our historic designation system, that include many properties that are eligible for higher levels of designation or could be restored to be contributing landmarks in the community. Since 1995, owners have been able to, with a one-page piece of paper, ask for removal and be given removal on the same day from that inventory. By filing that form with the city, you circumvent a 120-day delay that exists both in the code and in state law. So we've actually filed appeals based on the removal of these two buildings downtown from the historic resource inventory to say, you know, the public really deserves some time with a landmark, kind of a lowercase L landmark building like this, to decide whether we want all that material going to the landfill and whether we want that piece of history lost. And I think I'll say one more piece about the landfill, which is interesting. Portland has no requirement for architectural salvage or deconstruction of buildings. So when we tear down houses or tear down downtown buildings in a city as green as we are and as kind of concerned with recycling and reuse, we're throwing away entire buildings and hundreds of them every year with no requirement that that material be incorporated and reused. And there's some great work happening in the Bureau of Planning right now and among the salvage operators in town to advance some requirements to say, you know, we don't want whole buildings going to the landfill.
Who benefits by this kind of demolition?
Building owners and developers. And I'd like to say that our intention is not to, stamp development with a dastardly label. I mean, clearly we have to add density. Development needs to take place so that we can accommodate growth without sprawling out past the urban growth boundary. So we are at this interesting juncture in time where we have to very thoughtfully add that density, but not, in our opinion, at the cost of demolishing these increasingly rare historic assets. And we think we can accomplish both things. We can accomplish the goal of preserving heritage and all the embodied culture and materials that are inside of them, and we can add density. There, in the block where this building, where the Workman's Temple building stands, there are a couple of surface parking lots for which we're going, yeah, develop the heck out of those things. Add the density. Surface parking lots are not the best use of land. But we would assert that there's an opportunity to retain the historic buildings and add the development together and come up with a win-win.
Right. Let's go back to stories about the buildings. There's another historic building on that same lot slated for demolition. Can you say something about that, Brandon?
Yeah, I'll jump in. The other building on this block that many people might know better than the Workman's Temple is the Albion Hotel, which was built just after the turn of the century. And probably everyone in Portland knows it for the Lotus Cafe, which we might consider, we don't have an official designation for it, but a legacy business, a business that's been around since the 1920s here in Portland, a business that people from, so interesting, we were at City Council a few weeks ago to talk about this and many other issues. And the majority of the city commissioners had a story about either on the back of a napkin developing a planning idea that was implemented, or meeting with, you know, a kind of a prominent person in a social justice campaign in that cafe, because it's literally a kitty corner from City Hall. And so that is an institution that has meaning here in the city of Portland. Whether you go there every week or you had your first kiss there or something, it's been so interesting on social media to see people talk about their Lotus Cafe stories. And that's the type of sort of evolution of an institution that we should be thoughtfully considering.
Right. Can you say where are your appeals now? Do you have one both at the state and city level? Or
We're working with both the city and what they call the Land Use Board of Appeals. So we have filed an intent to appeal with LUBA, as they call the Land Use Board of Appeals. And we are pursuing options with the city in a dialogue. And I think that we have... I think there's some recognition growing that the city's policy is running contrary to the state statute, this idea that the circumvention of the 120-day demolition delay period. We're cautiously hopeful that we can, first of all, address the policy that enabled this situation to happen. So that's the larger issue. And we're very hopeful that some alternative ideas can come forward for that particular property. So, you know, it's just one of the things that we have to stay on top of as a city that is considering so many different aspects and facets of what makes us a quality place to live. And we just believe so strongly and are working so hard to ensure that these historic places, they're not making them like the Workman's Temple anymore. You asked if it was an opulent building. It probably wasn't particularly opulent in its day. It was just really, really well crafted, really, really well designed with old growth timber and craftsmanship and materials that are not being put into buildings today. So what a shame it would be to lose that and just make this assumption that, well, it looks all tired out. Let's just tear it down. We've seen so many buildings that people assumed were too far gone that were not in any way too far gone. And our office used to be in one of them, the White Stag building, where, you know, the Portland, Oregon sign sits on top of that building. It was a complete disaster before it was rehabilitated. And now it's become this fantastic catalyst for a lot of renewal within Old Town. So these historic places really are economic assets, not just kind of touchy-feely, fuzzy, nostalgic things. They are economic assets. People want to go visit them. They want to put their businesses in there. Isn't it interesting that all the new tech companies that are coming into town want to locate in the old, authentic buildings? I think that's a fascinating little dichotomy there. So these are precious places.
Yeah, I can't write code unless I see brick and beams.
Exactly. It's inspiring.
I just can't sit there. Are other cities more proactive in saving their historic resources? All right.
I think other cities and other states have a better policy framework than Oregon does. We're one of the few states that doesn't have a historic rehabilitation tax incentive or more financial incentives to help address the cost of historic restoration. And it's particularly keen, it's made more keen here in Oregon because we have issues with seismic retrofitting for unreinforced masonry buildings. So when you think about it, it's kind of crazy. We have both the seismic imperative hanging over our head and we have these wonderful historic assets and lack of financial tool that most other states have in place. And again, because we have such a, I want to call it a liberal owner consent policy that allows an owner to decide, you know what, I don't care how actually historic my building is, I don't want it to be designated, and no other state has that kind of a policy in place either. So and again, this isn't just to dish private property rights. There's this kind of balance between private property rights and the public responsibility, because your property doesn't sit on an island, right? It does have a public benefit. And there's a public benefit to retaining these historic places because all of the surrounding properties benefit from them and the population benefits from them. So there's just lots of considerations that need to be addressed.
Nice. Brandon, any other cities or states you can mention that are doing better?
Well, one of the things that, and I think there's a growing recognition of this here, one of the things that other cities regularly do is update that historic resource inventory. They send people out with clipboards and cameras and get neighborhoods involved in documenting what's significant about their neighborhood. The last time we did that was in 1985. A lot's changed. And it gives us an opportunity to get out in neighborhoods that maybe weren't even part of Portland east of 92nd, or neighborhoods that now we understand the significance of their story, like Albina and Sabin, King and Humboldt, and get into those neighborhoods and say, what buildings tell the story of this neighborhood in an era of rapidly changing demographics and neighborhood change with demolitions and gentrification? How can we proactively say, these are stories and buildings that we want to keep around because they're worth recognizing. And the mayor's office and Bureau of Planning and others have been talking about how do we make this happen and make this happen quickly. So I'm optimistic that we'll have a much better understanding of the places that make Portland authentic and unique through doing that inventory, coupled with some of the public policy discussions that Peggy's talking about, could give us something that pushes us ahead of other cities rather than where we've been, which is a little bit behind the curve in terms of the incentives and the documentation that's out there. And the great thing about an inventory project is it would enable teams of volunteers to document their neighborhood and tell their story so that the next generation of people, whether they're outsiders or homegrown people, will recognize what's special about Northeast MLK or 122nd and Powell. What are the special places there that need to be retained and used to tell that community story?
Right. Yeah. Biking around town, especially in Southeast, I see a lot of stop the demolition signs. Is strategy different in the neighborhoods than in downtown?
Well, I think there's several neighborhoods that are considering designating themselves as historic because that does, if you put your neighborhood on the National Register as a historic district, that does bring along with it the opportunity to have demolition denial. And so we're hearing from several neighborhoods that they're looking at how to designate themselves in a way that will afford a bit more protection. I think people, it's easy to slap up a sign. It's easy to kind of protest and spout off on Facebook and all that. And we do some of that. But we're trying to get ahead of it. It's really about digging into the planning process, looking at the policies, looking at both the financial. It's not just about regulating things to death either. It's about how do we incentivize good behavior. So there's no magic bullet that's gonna fix all this in one fell swoop. It's gonna be a multifaceted approach. Restore Oregon is making this one of our priorities, you have to stay on top of it. It's a moving target.
Brandon, is a historic designation for a neighborhood a good way to get some protection?
It would be if you wanted to protect a neighborhood. The historic designation is the best way to do that. That said, there are some very smart people out there who are serving on some of the city committees that we're involved with as well, who are talking about how to make it more desirable to own a historic house than to build a new one, and looking at ideas like streamlining the process or allowing for additional accessory dwelling units in basements or allowing for internal conversions of big old houses that maybe no longer want to be single family houses. So looking at the things in our code that may be getting in the way of us adding density and adding creative new uses to historic places, and how we can lower those barriers so people who own historic homes, people who own historic commercial buildings, actually have a competitive advantage in the marketplace to say, you know what, it's a better use of our investment to rehab this building than it is to build something new. So I think there's, like Peggy mentioned, there's some really great conversations happening right now from people all over the city looking at both encouraging reuse of buildings, but also sort of making it harder, at least making it hurt a little bit, to tear down a historic building or an older building and send it to the landfill.
All right. There was a section of Buckman that tried for the historic designation and failed by vote. And there was a lot of, it's scare tactics, but a lot of statements of over restriction if you're in a historic district. Can you address that issue?
Well, I think at one point, especially when it happened to coincide with the Buckman movement towards doing that designation, we did have in Portland, I think, some inappropriately high application fees and so forth if you were going to make alterations to your historic property. And we feel it's important that, in a compatible way, that people have flexibility with it. They've got to adapt them for living in the 21st century. So having certain flexibilities and while also retaining the integrity of the historic character, finding the right balance. Sometimes you have to go through design review. And sometimes those processes can get a little onerous and the fees can be a little high. And we worked to a coalition of folks worked to bring those fees down. But the interesting thing was, there was, when that was going on, there wasn't this big development boom. It was recession time, right? Now, it's interesting that the folks in Irvington who had just put their neighborhood on the National Register, I think there was some grumbling about some oversight that went along with that. Nobody's grumbling now because none of those demolitions are going on in Irvington. So I think there's this new appreciation for the, yeah, there's some carrots and there's some sticks that go along with the historic designation, and the historically designated neighborhoods are not experiencing the demolition epidemic that other neighborhoods are experiencing.
I heard a rate of a house a day.
Yeah.
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 I'm not an architect. Are a lot of those buildings going up ugly, though?
that's a subjective. Probably, we would say some of them are. We would say some of what's going up is not an improvement on what was there, for sure. Not everything needs to be saved. You know, there's some stuff that should come down and could definitely be replaced with something that serves the neighborhood better, that does add density. But it's been fascinating to realize that only single digits of all these demolitions. Just less than 10% have actually been replaced with something that added meaningful density. And by that we mean more than a 2-to-1 kind of replacement. In many, many cases, these have just been replaced by bigger single-family homes. So it doesn't address the density issue, but it does affect neighborhood integrity and character and affordability.
Hmm. Brandon, anything to add to that?
I think one of the things that's really interesting, we talk about this kind of tear down trend around town. I think we've all seen it. We've seen the excavator bringing down an old house. Over a quarter of those houses we're tearing down are more than a century old. And the average age of a house we're demolishing is in the 1920s. So what we're talking about is buildings with old growth lumber. We're talking about buildings that were built during a time that electricity wasn't as readily available. So they have passive heating and cooling systems. And they also contribute to a neighborhood fabric, you know, a thoughtful approach to how we designed something like Buckman, with tightly packed houses built around the turn of the century that have a lot of opportunity to add density within those existing envelopes and not be replaced by just another single family house. And certainly there are those houses out there that aren't worth keeping. And there's those houses out there that are on our main streets that maybe are proposed for a better replacement. Those do exist. But the majority of demolitions we're seeing right now aren't meaningfully doing anything for us as a community. They're adding some housing options that aren't affordable to most, and they're adding an element of design that maybe is, and not just in style, but in terms of the scale, the massing, the feeling of the house, that is wildly out of character with their neighbors. I think we have many examples of great infill houses built in a host of styles, modern styles, traditional styles, that fit their neighborhood, that are done by somebody thoughtfully, and I think those are really good examples of where neighborhoods can change to become better, but that's not the majority of what we're seeing right now.
All right, well, it's come to the time where I say, what can listeners do who want to help with this process?
Well, we really hope that they will check out Restore Oregon's website and consider supporting us and following us. I think, too, they can be engaged with their neighborhood association. They can show up. One of the things we'll put up on our website and on our Facebook page are when there's times we can come testify for City Hall or at public hearings. We will help get that word out and come and share your stories. And I think people can be, by just paying attention and kind of weighing in on this issue as being significant to them, it helps gain the attention of our civic leaders who, let's face it, their attention is spread really thin these days between a lot of compelling and broadly different issues. So I would say engage with your neighborhood, engage with us, come participate in the public hearings that are available, and individually be good stewards of your home, your street.
Nice. Brandon, anything listeners can do past the lawn sign?
Yeah, well, I agree with Peggy. I was at one of my favorite bars last night, the Loyal Legion, which is a historic building in Southeast Portland, adaptively reused, and overheard a conversation of people debating the merits of density and preservation. And it just is, it's a really interesting community conversation. And I think keeping that conversation alive and then taking the time to write a city commissioner or to attend a public meeting and say, you know, there's a better way for us to achieve a great city here in Portland. And we've got to be thinking about, reusing buildings. We've got to be thinking about deconstructing those buildings that aren't going to stick around for a long time, thinking about investing in and living in a historic building and what that might mean. So I think that that conversation is a really good thing that's going on, because I think everyone in the community now is aware that there is something special in Portland that we might be losing, and we can be proactive and smart and keep that around.
Thanks so much for talking to KVU.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joe.
That was Peggy Moretti and Brandon Spencer Hartle from Restore Oregon. A combination of state and city code makes Portland one of the most demolition-friendly cities in the country. Our neighborhoods are losing a century-old home every day. The best protection there seems to be the creation of historic districts. This succeeded in Irvington and narrowly failed in Buckman. In downtown Portland, the Workman's Temple and the Lotus Cafe are both endangered by proposed megadevelopment. These buildings remind us of a time when fraternal lodges and community benefit organizations were more important than multinational corporations' bottom line. Who would build a Workman's Temple today? To find out more about our efforts to save our historic buildings and the cultures they embody, visit RestoreOregon.org. That's it for this edition of Democracy Here! I'm your host, Joe Meyer, and Sisyphus is happy!
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the NARA New Year's Eve Sobriety Powwow on Thursday, December 31st from 1 p.m. to midnight at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. Grand entry will be at 1 and 6 p.m. with honorings, Ed Goodell as the whip man, NARA All Nations Drum as the host drum, and MC Philip Archambault. Again, that's the NARA New Year's Eve Sobriety Powwow, Thursday, December 31st, from 1 p.m. to midnight at the Oregon Convention Center, Hall A and B, 777 Northeast Martin Luther King Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
And now the KBOO News at noon for December 21st, 2015, the winter solstice and the shortest day of the year. In local news, the three water reservoirs on Mount Tabor were officially disconnected from the city water system and no longer provide any water to the city. The reservoirs were ordered closed after new U.S. EPA regulations required all open drinking water reservoirs throughout the country to either be covered or disconnected. But the reservoirs will remain on Mount Tabor. The Portland Water Bureau, in conjunction with the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association, agreed to preserve and restore the historical appearance of the three reservoirs. To accomplish those goals, the Portland Water Bureau is asking the City Council for $750,000 in next year's budget to hire a preservation consultant. The City Council has already agreed to spend up to $4 million on the restoration project. A new report on housing affordability has